Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, joined not as always. July is crazy. I've been traveling. You guys have been traveling. We've been kind of like just getting whatever two are together. But it's you and me today. And the boy Ronnie is on like a fake fly fishing trip. Did I hear this correctly? I have friends who listen to the show, and he's out doing something masculine, which is wild.
But you know, in his own description, he is going with guys who are doing that while he enjoys the whatever sort of lodge accommodations they have, and he was amused at his own presence on this trip. So that's I think that's probably. You know, he was not posing as as an outdoorsman or something.
Interesting. Yeah, I hope the lighting is good in the lobby for the Instagrams, and they'll come back after a day of fly fishing, and he will have like written a poem about an acorn and taken some pictures of himself. But that's wild, Pipe. I actually have more to ask you on fly fishing, and more to ask you about this trip and trips in general. We'll get into all that right after this quick break.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Scott. As a servant of God, wife, and mother of four, I understand the juggle of multiple roles and stages. That's why I created the Encourager podcast, to help guide us through the messy middle stage of life. Join me on the Encourager as we challenge the chaos and embrace harmony. Together, we'll create practical systems to balance your roles and fulfill priorities. And we will do it while having joy and energy for both home and work life. Tune in for inspiring stories and interviews, actionable tips, and methods to do both home and work life. Because here, we believe you can do all things, just not all at once.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, Pipe. Do you remember like the first like Christians with money fly fishing boom in like the late 90s? Did that get to you up in Minnesota? It kind of came on the heels of a movie called A River Runs Through It that was kind of the first big Brad Pitt thing. Do you remember this?
I do remember A River Runs Through It, and in classic Christian fashion, 7 years late, because that movie came out in like 1993. So if it was the late 90s, perfect timing. We're only 6 or 7 years behind the arc on this. I kind of remember it, but like I was young enough. Well, two things. One, I was young enough that I didn't totally register it. And also, my dad's preaching scared away all the people with money from our church.
Yes.
So we didn't have a lot of rich people doing luxurious things at our church. And we didn't have sort of the, like the West Michigan money or like the small town thing where there's like a bunch of working class people and then like two or three families who are like the whales.
Dude, that's legit. That's a real thing.
Oh yeah. But we didn't, we didn't really have that. And so I was generally aware of it. Also, I think in Minnesota, it might have been a little different just because it's such a lake culture anyway that like, fly fishing, like a fly fishing excursion doesn't make sense when somebody's like, I'm out on the lake fishing for walleye every weekend anyway during the, between Memorial Day and, snow. So,
well, and in the winter when it gets cold, I'm drilling a hole in the ice and I'm ice fishing. Right. Maybe. So, yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, down in Indiana where I was, it was a real interesting thing because the only like rich Christian older dudes I had access to were like Taylor profs. And they weren't rich because Taylor was paying them a lot. They were rich because they went to Taylor and you have to kind of be rich to go there. So they had money. A River Runs Through It comes out. And then all of a sudden, they're like eschewing golf, right? So golf is the traditional like pit that you throw money into and light it on fire because you can constantly be like buying gear and different crap for the sport and all that. And then all of a sudden, they're all like, oh, I got my new waders. I'm teaching myself to tie flies. And it was all kind of the same type of guy. They weren't really like outdoorsmen. They were sort of like, I have money. I want to think of myself as an outdoorsman. I saw this movie. Something about it resonated with me. I want to be a certain kind of guy, and I'm gonna go do these trips.
So my cul-de-sac is depressing.
My cul-de-sac is depressing. I'm bored at work. I want to be like Brad Pitt in The River Runs Through It. So I'm gonna go take this trip and do this thing. And so as a result, I feel like I know what every single person on Ronnie's trip looks like without being on the trip. You know, I can describe them all.
See,
perfectly.
I would make one slight adjustment to your description, and it is that the people who were doing this didn't want to be like Brad Pitt. Who was the dad? Was it Tom Skerritt?
Dude, it was Tom Skerritt. Yeah. Great
they
memory.
They wanted to be
you.
Tom Skerritt, this grounded man of faith who's trying yeah. to like he's got sons who he deeply loves, and one of them is sort of prodigal sonish. And so yeah. they wanted to be the deep man of substance with a cool mustache, yeah. Much more than like the hot young guy. Like you resonated with yeah. Brad Pitt because you were like 19 totally. Or 20 at the time. They yeah. resonated with Tom Skerritt, which is a sentence I never thought I would say about anybody.
I wanted to be Brad Pitt minus the fishing, but yeah, no, they definitely resonated with Tom Skerritt. Yeah, firm hand spiritually, two kids who hate me, you know, it all kind of checks out. But that was actually a great movie that I need to revisit. I haven't seen that one in over
yeah,
a decade
that,
and a half,
that movie
probably.
To me was like reading To Kill a Mockingbird in school, in that mm-hmm. everybody said it was awesome and I abhorred it. Hated it so
really?
Much. Well, I was like 12. So
yeah,
yeah,
oh, yeah.
That
you
movie
were too
came
young.
Out and I was
yeah.
like, this sucks. Yeah. This is so boring. They don't do anything.
Sure.
And and then, you know, like To Kill a Mockingbird, I read it in my, you know, in my adulthood and was like, oh, I get it now. And I haven't yeah. revisited A River Runs Through It because my lasting impression is this movie is terrible. And yeah. which means I'm trusting my 12-year-old self, which is not a great way to go through life. So I need to revisit it to see how quality it actually is.
Dude, what's interesting about it is that it's almost like a lighter version of Legends of the Fall.
Okay.
Which was another movie that yeah. Brad Pitt did a little bit later in the 90s, which I absolutely love. Really, really kind of heavy family epic about sin with like a little crackle of redemption in it. But no fly fishing, which is why older Christian dudes with money didn't resonate with Legends of the Fall much like they did with A River Runs Through It. But thoughts and prayers with Ronnie. Hopefully they have a good internet connection there in the lobby for all of his Instagram.
I hope he comes back with a Tom Skerritt quality mustache.
He's not going to come back with a Tom Skerritt quality anything. I hate to break it to you. If anything, he'll come back driven more further into the kind of position that he already occupies, which is like, I'm not a masculine guy. I'm the arty guy, which this is a good trip for him in that he gets to be in a beautiful vistas kind of place, but he gets to be the unique guy that's kind of like different, you know. This trip was actually made for him. So I think it's going to make him happy. He's going to have a lot of good pictures as a result of it. But Pipe, another thing, another trip that people could get a lot of good pictures out of. It's a little trip to Indianapolis in September for the Happy Rant live show, the last show. What are the details on that, Pipe? Where can they get tickets? Why should they get tickets?
Well, as Simon Sinek once said, start with why. So let's lead off with that in true leadership fashion. the reason to get tickets to the show. As Ted said, there's a sense of urgency. There's a sense of mourning, if you will, because this is a farewell show. This will be our ride off into the sunset. So it will be our last ever live show. We intend for it to be our last ever podcast. And for that reason, we're actually going to try. I don't know if that'll make it better, but we are going to try. We have a couple of sponsors lined up with some great giveaways. Josh Byers of Visual Theology is designing custom t-shirts for people who get tickets. And his work is spectacular. It's going to be awesome. I think it'll be a blast. We'll have a great time. So the details are September 24th. That's a Sunday, 7 p.m. It's going to be at Soma Church Midtown in Indianapolis, just a few minutes from where the Gospel Coalition Conference will be held. So if you're planning to be there for TGC, come in a little bit early. Or Indianapolis is easy driving distance from like half the country, so just pop on over for it. And if you go to thehappyrant.com and click on the live show, you can get all the details there, so you don't need to remember any of this. And we have two tiers of tickets. We have a $35 ticket, and then we have a $50 ticket that includes that custom t-shirt that is unique for this event. And a whole bunch of you have already bought tickets, so we're going to have a great crowd, which enhances the whole event because we love interacting with our listeners. We love the Q&A times. We love the times between the recorded episodes where we get to just mingle with folks. So having a crowd there is going to be awesome. It should be a blast. September 24th, Indianapolis. Go to thehappyrant.com to get your tickets.
Dude, I love it. That's my absolute favorite venue of all time. Indianapolis is a great, underrated American city. It's super easy to navigate and super fun to be in. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And Pipe, I'm starting to get a little bit happening in the old emotions when I think about closing the show down. And I'm starting, this is a 100% earnestness now. The emails are starting to trickle in from people about various hard seasons of life that they've been in where, for whatever reason, listening to the rant was like the one little ray of sunshine in their life. And yeah, I'm starting to become moved by those things. So
I don't laugh. I just laugh because you say starting to become moved. It's like your cold, icy heart is thawing.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't have a cold, icy heart.
Right.
As you know, I'm quick to show emotion, but I haven't felt especially emotional about this, but it's starting, you know. And I think being there in Indy, being in my old city, being with a room full of people, like it's going to be an interesting night, man. It's going to be kind of wild.
Yeah.
And I look forward to it.
Yeah, there's the old phrase, like, you know, we laughed, we cried. And generally speaking, our shows are just we laughed, you know, we laughed and we left. And it's possible there could be crying at this. I don't know. I mean, I have gotten responses from people. You know, we periodically get listener feedback that is that kind of catches me off guard because of how heartfelt it is. Like you said, in terms of how this show and its sort of lightheartedness, not taking ourselves seriously, has played a role in seeing people through difficult times, difficult church situations, loss of loved ones even, which astounds me because I don't think we think of this as important.
No.
And so that
we don't.
That piece, I mean, and ultimately, I don't think those people think of this show as important,
right?
You know, in terms of like what we say is especially profound, as much as just it's a little bit like old friends. You know, you just they're sort of we're the pleasant old friend, sort of a nostalgic thing. Also, I forget that when you do something for a decade, you actually can become part of someone's life. And
that's true.
There's a weird reality where when we sit in our own, you know, home studios, which in my case is a desk in my bedroom with a microphone, you don't feel super personally attached to who is listening because you can't.
Right.
And so to hear that back, it's really meaningful, but it's also really, it catches me off guard. So I'm very excited and I don't know how I will feel in a room with, I don't know, 75, 100, 150 listeners who have a distinct relationship with this show.
Yeah, totally. And I appreciate that they do have that relationship. And I can tell you, and you'll resonate with this as a writer, it's a different kind of relationship than you get as a writer. Like we've both you know, by God's grace, been able to write books about which occasionally people email and say, you know, it really resonated with me, or it really helped me through a hard time, or I really enjoyed just reading your work or whatever. And that is a certain kind of relationship, but it's not, you know, people aren't reading our book every week for 10 years, you know. And the relationship that you have with the podcast is a different kind of relationship. So yeah, I dare say I'm going to be a little earnest and sappy and probably emotional when we do the live show, probably more than I would like to be, but it's going to be cool, man. And I look forward to it. And I think, and this transitions into something else that I wanted to talk about. I think there's something to be said, Pipe, for Christians like grieving well. And not just when somebody dies, but like transitions in life or things ending. Like even, you know, for me with these camp gigs, I have such a deep connection, as deep as it can be in a week. You know, yeah. Like you're preaching twice a day. You're talking to kids all day long about their lives. Sometimes it's hard stuff. Sometimes it's just fun ha-has. But you know, you're talking to people and you feel like you're really a part of each other's lives for a week, and then you leave. And this is sort of the problem with camp, right? Like as a camper or as a speaker, you make these like camp friendships. And then as you're driving away, whether you're a camper on a bus or me in a car, like you feel sad, you know? And there's a sense of, you want to put things in their proper place and do justice to it and not just take advantage of whatever technology is at your fingertips to like forget about it as quickly as possible and quash the emotion, you know? So I think as Christians, we could get better at like grieving things well. And for me, like nobody taught me how to do it. Like that's something I learned like way later into adulthood, but I am glad that I've learned it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's interesting because several years ago I had a friend who, you know, was going through, she was making kind of a lifestyle transition where like she had never been a heavy drinker, but she, she drank some and she had a little bit of alcoholism in her family. And so she was like, I'm going to give up drinking. And, and somebody told her, you know, it was a hard change for her. And somebody told her, you know, oh, you're going through a grieving process. And at the time I thought, that's absurd. Like just, that's ridiculous. Yeah. Like it, yeah, just buck up kind of thing. And yeah. I think as I've, you know, in the years since and walking with different people through different hard things and just my own hard things, realizing there is an element of grieving at any loss of significance. If something of significance goes out of your life, like, you know, even if you've had a car for 10 years and then it gets totaled, there's a sense of like loss, you know?
Yeah.
Totally. And so that's, it is something where that sounds petty or fragile or, you know, overly sappy, but I think there is a sense in which there's a grief that's appropriate to the loss. And what we're not good at as Christians is recognizing that anything smaller than like the death of a loved one or a national tragedy deserves grief, you know?
Yeah, no,
so
you're absolutely right.
The grief has to sort of fit the loss, but losses bring about grief. And so we can acknowledge that and be fine with it.
Yeah, totally. And life is full of little losses. You know, I remember, I know I've told this story before probably on the show, but the day that my son Tristan started college, we had to like scrap a Cadillac that had been in our family for like a decade.
I rode mine in that Cadillac.
Yes, you did, dude. It was mine. And then I sold it to my son when he got his license. He bought it from me and he loved it. And yeah, first day of him starting college, you know, it coincided with the car like breaking down and we had to take it to the scrapyard. And man, we both shed a few tears that morning because that, you know, it was a part of our life and a lot of memories were made in it. And then it was his first vehicle. And you know, it would have been easy to like, especially for a couple of kind of hyper masculine dudes to like stuff that down. And then it would come out as anger later, you know, it would come out in like less great ways later on. And I know this because I, you know, did that for the better part of my life. But yeah, I think for him and me, grieving it together was a good thing. We can thank the Lord for it and for all the good times we had and then let it go, you know? So, yeah, I think there's some good in that. Pipe, I want to take a break. I want to come back. I want to close the book on booms. I want to run a couple of other like booms in kind of adult male life by you, and then talk a little retirement. We'll do all that after this quick break. All right, Piper, thinking about the fly fishing boom made me think about both the cigar boom and the poker boom. I feel like all these coincided with like the internet starting. The poker boom coincided with a movie called Rounders, a Matt Damon movie.
Absolutely.
From like the late 90s. Yeah,
100%.
And the cigar boom, I don't know what started it, actually.
Spurgeon.
Maybe Spurgeon in the Christian community. I don't know what started it in like the regular community. Maybe like Michael Jordan smoking cigars while he golfed or whatever. But did you participate in either of those two booms?
Definitely yes to one, and pretty definitely not to the other. I was never a poker guy. I hate games in general. Like, I tried to like poker.
Dude, that's so interesting. And yeah, more on that.
I've always had friends who, you know, there's like the Settlers of Catan friends, or the, board game, strategy game friends. And like, nothing is more soul sucking to me than those games. I hate them. I don't hate the people who play them. It's just like,
right.
I mean, it's like if somebody invited me to come over and like change the brakes on his car, I'd be like, that's a you thing. Like, I'm really glad you enjoy that. I do not want to spend a third of my Saturday doing that thing. And poker falls into that. It feels the same way, even though it's much more sort of social, interactive, trash talking, whatever. Yeah. Like, it does involve a lot of things that I enjoy, which is hanging out with guys who I like. Usually involves beverages that are delicious. Depending on the context, there may be smoking involved, which is another thing that I enjoy. And I just don't enjoy the game. I don't enjoy gambling. It's not really a moral thing as much as I don't get any pleasure out of it. So I skipped the poker thing, although I thought Rounders was a great movie.
Rounders was such a cool movie. And I remember very much, so Rounders happened when I was like, you know, just getting married in my early 20s, and dudes would like, as a result of Rounders, dudes were like getting poker sets and like starting poker nights. And I always remember thinking, this is really cool in theory. And then I would go and I would play and I would come back and it'd be like, oh, I just spent 6 hours away from my wife. I don't know. I lost like $12 or whatever. And I didn't enjoy the game that much. I think I'm exactly like you in terms of like board games, tabletop games, card games. Like, I like them in theory, but then whenever I do them, I'm always just kind of like, huh, I could have watched, you know, 2.5 hours of tape, like football games, or I could have watched boxing, or I could have chatted with somebody, or I could have done literally anything else that I like doing, and it would have been better than that. It never really took off for me. And I think to really enjoy poker, and maybe Settlers of Catan is like this, you have to be a certain kind of like strategic math guy.
Yeah.
And I'm not that guy.
No.
I'm just not a strategic math guy at all. I'm a guy who, like, I can embody the vibes of Rounders. And I love Vegas. I love, like, you know, seedy back room, like, have to know the secret handshake kind of, like, scenarios. I enjoy that stuff very much. But, like, the actual poker playing always left a little to be desired for me.
Yeah, and I feel very much like I could write 1,000 words about a guy's poker night that would be more interesting than the game of poker. Just resonating with what you said about things that I do well and things that I don't do well. I don't know how to do those games well, and I understand the principle. That's the thing, is it's not being a novice. It's just like, my brain doesn't click this way. However, I could write a really funny essay about these guys hanging out together or something like that.
And it speaks to something really interesting, which is, and not to get all like, I'm the 35-year-old small groups pastor at your church with a Jesus fish tattoo or whatever, but like, it speaks to the idea that men do want to hang out.
Yes.
You know, and I remember thinking about the cigar boom and the poker boom specifically, and the fly fishing boom, to be honest. Like, dudes just want to hang out. They want to know and be known. And it seemed kind of silly that we have to have a poker game to like justify it, you know, like we could just hang out, you know, and I think that's what I like about the cigar boom. You know, it's very much like, yeah, light up a cigar if you want, if it makes you feel masculine or whatever, but really we're just hanging out and talking, you know, which is what we wanted to do anyway. And I happen to love cigars, so, you know, it's a win-win for me. But that boom kind of gave Christian dudes permission to hang out in ways that they kind of hadn't had before. And I do like that about it, you know?
Yeah, and I think the cigar boom has matured, because the poker boom always felt like, you know, there was like 8% of the guys who loved poker. There was 80% of the guys who loved hanging out. And then there was a bunch of us who were like, I would love to hang out. I'm not doing that. That's dumb.
Yeah.
Whereas cigars, there was a pretense around it. Where like, if you didn't smoke a cigar and you didn't hang out, like, what's the matter with you? Grow a pair kind of thing. And which is, you know, it's that immature type of response.
Yeah.
And then there were guys who didn't feel like they could come because like, oh, it's a cigar night. I don't smoke cigars. And what I feel like it's matured to now is there are guys who really love cigars and guys who don't. And so you go hang out and smoke cigars, and the guys who don't want to, like, bring their 40-ounce clean canteen of water and still hang out. Yeah. It's totally fine. And so it's just it's become a thing, which I think is more like what cigars were, you know, like in Spurgeon's day. Those who liked them smoked them. You know, after dinner you go and you pour, you know, port or whatever and have a cigar, and the guys who want one, and the guys who don't, but there's just this sort of time together. So the poker boom died because it couldn't mature, I think. The cigar thing has not gone away. It's just sort of grown up.
Yeah, no, it has. And it's aged better because I think it's more enjoyable to more people. You know, there was always going to be a ceiling on the number of guys who actually enjoyed playing poker.
Yeah.
You know, despite it being, remember when poker was like, you would flip on ESPN2 any time of the day or night and poker was on it. This would have been like, you know, 2001 to 2011 or whatever.
Genuinely infuriated me.
Yeah, me too.
Because
I want to watch a sport.
I know. Yeah. I want to watch a sport. And I realize it's entertainment and Sports Network or whatever, but I'm like, this isn't even entertaining. Yeah. This is utterly boring. I would rather watch highlights from a 1983 Celtics game or something. Like, just anything.
Totally. Yeah. Play an old game, play an old fight, like anything.
Show me some
other
bloopers.
Than like some guy with a paunch and like bags under his eyes with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth, like staring at a handful of cards. You know, it just seemed like fundamentally opposed to what ESPN purported to be. But crazy. Pipe, let's take a break. On the other side of it, I want to talk about ideal retirement jobs. We'll be back. Okay, we're back. Piper, you posed this question in our chat. What do you want to do job-wise after you retire from your main thing? So for you, it would be pastoring. For me, it will be professoring, ostensibly, if Christian higher ed survives the next decade. But what do we want to do in retirement? I think this is a fascinating question because it presupposes that we will want to do something, which in my case, and I think in yours, is actually true. I'm not one of these guys who like thinks about retirement as just this exercise and sort of waking up in the morning and wondering how I'm going to kind of pleasure myself. You know, I do think about what I want to do in retirement. What kind of thoughts do you have on it?
Yeah, I think retirement in general is sort of fundamentally opposed to human flourishing. The especially when people are like, I want to retire at 65. I'm like, these days, 65 means you have 20 years of life left. And 20 years of doing nothing productive sounds like actual living hell to me.
I agree.
Now, I do think there's a downshift in pace. You know, there's a period of life where you're sort of maximally energetic and maximally capable, kind of skilled in your field. And that usually usually like in your 30s, you reach the point where you know enough and have enough energy to be really good. And that carries you through your 40s. And then in your 50s, you know a ton and you start to slow down a little bit. And that's why, like, in your 60s, you probably have the most expertise, but also physically are slowing down more, and so you downshift. So, yeah, but anyway, I can't imagine doing nothing at some point in my life. Like, I need to wake up and go, what am I going to put my hand to today, even if it's just a project or something? So that's kind of the premise of this. And it was also, it's also the premise of kind of the sad side of this is where, you know, you go into like a fast food joint and you see like a 78-year-old woman wiping down tables. And sometimes those ladies are joyful. Like they're greeting people. They love it. They give the sense of loving it. Other times you're like, this is out of necessity. And that feels sad to me. So all of that goes into my thought process here. But the way that in my mind though, it's much more romantic than that. It's a picture of what kind of old man do I see myself being? Like,
yes.
You know, where do I picture myself being an old man? Doing what? So it's kind of that thought, not so much like, well, the math is going to add up to this and yada yada, my 401k, whatever. That's boring. Right. Who cares? So that's the picture I have in my mind is like, what is a 78-year-old me doing? And that's the posture of the question.
That's really good, dude. And it's really fun to think about. And I want to say something in response to what you just said before we say the things that we maybe could see ourselves doing. I do know people who do nothing. And I'm not going to say who they are because it would hurt feelings, but I know like old people who were kind of in that like north of 65, but well south of death window, who just have a ton of money and do nothing. And I don't have the courage to do this, but I would love to interview them and be like, how do you do it? You know, like, because I look at their lives and I think this looks miserable. Because there's no purpose to your life. There's no reason for you existing. How do you do it? But that would really hurt their feelings. But I am curious. You know what I mean? But I think the vast majority of us exist in the other camp, which is, a week or two of that, and I would be climbing the walls. You know, I've been this way since childhood, and I gather that you are this way too. And this is a spiritual issue is too strong a word, but I think it's a spiritual situation. Like, I need to know why I exist. You know what I mean? I need to know in general kind of why the Lord has me on the planet, whether that's to write stuff or mow lawns or whatever it is. I need to know that I have a purpose beyond just planning my next trip, you know, or my next cruise or whatever it is.
There is a real distinct sort of moral and theological component to this for me. And I don't want a soapbox, but maybe I can't help it. I don't know. We were not put here to simply exist and to simply use resources.
Right.
We were put here for the good, like to contribute to the good of the body of Christ primarily, but the good of creation. Like, what are we doing that matters? And if we are spending 20% of our lives doing jack crap, that is a profoundly self-centered mindset. And I'm not picking on individuals as much as a mindset that has been handed down by, I would say, the kind of the baby boomer generation, where like the goal is to earn as much as possible so you can do as little as possible.
Yes.
That's just unbiblical. Like, that is, unless you're earning as much as possible so you can give it all away or be as generous as possible, benefit others, help others. But again, there's purpose in that. You're doing something with your money, whether it's, you know, funding organizations or helping out families or whatever. So that's kind of the premise of this for me. It's not, you know, the ugly side of that is I need to earn the right to exist, you know, sort of a sense of like frantic.
Yeah.
I need to be able to look in the mirror and feel good about myself. That's also unbiblical.
Yeah.
But there is a sense of like, if I have breath in my body and energy in my bones, like I should be doing something to to benefit somebody, even if it's just like I watch grandkids for an hour a day to give to give daughter a break or something like that. Like that really matters. Those things are significant.
Dude, those things are significant and they're noble and they're worth wanting. You know what I mean? And this is a really interesting one because, and this is going to sound like a meme, you know, it's become one, but like hearing your dad talk about this, I don't know, X number of years ago, whenever I heard it, was like actually really helpful for me because I was like, oh, that's kind of how I've always felt about it. Like I want to exist for some purpose that's larger than just going on vacation or whatever. And so that was helpful, but yeah, I think so quickly in our camp pipe, like things that are aspirational and good like that become law because we, you know, we get our hands on them and we wring the life out of them and we just make them into law. Like you have to work after you're retired, give yourself 2 weeks and then go, you know, work or whatever. And yeah, like I want my life to have purpose. I want to be a servant, right? Like I want to serve people. I want to serve my church and my family, Lord willing. And, you know, all these things hopefully will matter to me then. So I've got a couple of ideas and I want to hear you on yours. Obviously there's the like outlandish dreams, like, I don't know, maybe I'll own a minor league baseball team or whatever, which I'm sure won't be the case, but that would be fun. I think more realistic for me, I've got two. So I'm thinking 65, 68, 70. Hopefully I can still move around some. I hope I'm still coaching the long snappers at Lane College. Lord willing, there will still be college football then. We'll still be here. I'll still have a relationship with Lane. We just had we just opened camp, you know, a few days ago. So I've been out working with our long snappers and dude, I absolutely love it. I'm reminded every year how much I enjoy being out there in the heat, you know, working with these guys. And I think at 70, I could still be doing that, you know, and that would be a lot of fun. The other one that I think would be cool is I wouldn't mind like cutting the grass at my college. So we got a lot of we got a lot of acreage there at Union, and my son Maxim is working full time on the grounds crew this summer, and they have really nice mowers. And sometimes I'll look out my office window and I'll see him like, you know, kind of ripping around on those nice like zero turn mowers, and I'll think, I could see myself doing that after I retire from the classroom. I'll still be around. It'll still be like fun to be on a college campus, ripping around on a mower. I could see it. I like cutting the grass.
Man, I did grounds crew a couple summers at Wheaton, and you know, because I stayed there between school years, and it was a fun job. Like it's hard work, you know. It's basically landscaping, but there was so there's one or two full time guys who they're just like the full time grounds crew guys, and you know they seemed really old to me. They were probably late 50s, early 60s.
Yep.
But like one of them was a total jerk. Like he thought all the kids were a nuisance. I'm like, why do you work at a college if you hate 19 year olds? other one was just a blast. Like he's the one whose crew you wanted to be on because he kind of set the pace. Like you didn't want to outwork him because he'd make fun of you. But he worked hard enough that you would get the job done. And he's the one who set breaks and he had a good sense of humor and, you know, that kind of. And like the old guy working with the college kids he's a gift to the 19-year-old who's sweating during the summer, you know, laying down mulch or whatever.
Yeah, that's an awesome guy to be, you know, to be the awesome old guy. And dude, it's so funny you say that because the two old guys running the department is actually like exactly the model at Union. And it's just, it's really funny that model kind of hasn't changed, but I could see a lot of joy in being just an old guy on the crew. What about you for like retirement-esque gigs or ways to spend your time?
So I think the outlandish one is, first of all, just premise is that I think it's wise for people in pastoral ministry to retire before they think they need to. Or to step away from, because there's a benefit in a good handoff, you know, and you don't want to be forced out. You don't want people to wish you were gone. You want people to miss you when you're gone, and then, but also to set up the next guy for success. And, you know, like that's the young guy who's probably 40. So I anticipate, assuming that the Lord gives me the fortitude and wisdom to do these things, stepping out of a full-time role before I need to, which leaves me with, you know, 15, 20 years of probably enough energy to do stuff. So the sort of like pipe dream, and I have no idea what the track to this would be, is like bartender at a neighborhood bar.
Oh my gosh, dude, that rips. And that would be unbelievable.
And not like some hipster Nashville bar, but I'm thinking like like there's a place down the street from me called Jolly Ollie's.
Yeah.
And it's a pizza and pub. And which means that like they're not doing like nobody's coming in and asking for an espresso martini. You know, you're
pulling beers.
You're pulling beers. Like, you're making fun of people for their order. You're kicking out drunks. You know, you're chopping it up with, you know, rednecks and whatever. Families come in. Like, it's a little bit. So that kind of joint, like, that would be fun to me. And there's a few other places where it's more like, you know, it's kind of just the bar. Like, you come in and it's like just a row of seats and maybe a couple tables and that kind of thing. I could see that. And again, not like full time, but, you know. Some weeknight shifts, that kind of thing would be, I think that'd be a ton of fun. And I think there's a fair amount of overlap between bartending and pastoring when it comes to people interaction.
Dude, I was just going to say that. And I was going to ask, like, how are you with sad drunks? Because I think I'm pretty good with them. There would be a fair amount of ministry in a job like that. Because you're gonna encounter some sad drunks. And I think I'm
fairly decent with them. But then, and this is a distinct parallel between bartender and pastors. You reach a point where you go, shut up and go home. Like, fine. You can moan about this or you can do something about this. But what you can't do is sit here. So and so I think there are some parallels. And I realize as a pastor, you don't tell people shut up. But that's you find a very Christian way of being like, you've talked enough about this. Go take some steps to work on this problem. And so I can see some parallels. You know, you got to deal with some rowdies. You occasionally have to be like, y'all can't do that in here. You're going to have to take a hike. So I could see that job being a ton of fun. I also think, like, you know, you talked about, you talk about continuing to coach. Coaching is one of those things that I have always I've done a little bit of it, but not in years, more like in my college and just post-college days, coached some baseball and stuff, but getting involved with like a local middle school, local high school to do some baseball or football coaching at not at like a head coach level. I don't want all that, but, like skills coaching, position coaching, you know, I could coach a D-line. I could coach infielders for a baseball team, those kinds of things. Would be a lot of fun because one of the things that I really like, just a big premise is I want to be an old guy who makes young people not feel like they're being crapped on by old people.
Oh yeah, that's huge.
In whatever capacity.
Yeah, we've all had coaches like that. I feel like every staff has kind of the wizened old guy on it. And, you know, first day of camp, you're a freshman, you move in, that guy seems like a little old and gruff, and you're like, oh, that guy's going to be mean. But then, like, I don't know, middle of day two, you realize, oh, that guy's actually super cool. And he's actually, like, way less wound up than, like, the young dudes on the staff, and he's got nothing to prove. Yeah, being that guy on a coaching staff is a super cool role to inhabit. And it's actually, it's more fun than being the cool young guy. And everybody thinks being the cool young guy is the move, but that would be a great one.
I've always had an affinity for idiots too. Like, when I did youth ministry, when I coached, I mean even as a pastor, like the not like bad kids, but like just the kids who are just, they're kind of causing a ruckus. I've always liked those kids. When I say kids now, I'm talking about like 27-year-olds at, you know, a while back it was 13 or 17-year-olds. And I think being the old coach kind of puts you in a position to have a distinct impact on those young guys because you can kind of absorb anything. Like, what are they going to do? Shock you? And yeah. and so it gives you the ability and the freedom to talk them up, to coach them, to appropriately challenge them as well as affirm yeah. them. And usually people are knuckleheads because they need attention and they need affirmation, or they lack those things. And so if you can give it to them yeah. in the right way and then, you know, give them a direction, you've done some good work.
100%. Yeah, for sure. Well said, Pipe. Well, we've planned our retirements. These sound pretty good. If anything, I just kind of can't wait for the next 20 years to go by so that
I can kick this
plan into high gear. Yeah, yeah. No, these are good. This has been fun, Pipe. It was good to knock the rust off, get back in the studio, do some radio. Pipe, we've done what we always do on this program. And until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Need more of God's power in your life? I'm Christina Patterson, host of the Teach Us to Pray podcast, providing practical tips on how to grow your faith through prayer. Subscribe at lifeaudio.com.